Hello, and welcome to Manga Explaining, the show where we recommend great manga to folks who haven't read much manga before. Hosted by Deb Aoki, Christopher Woodrow Butcher, Chip Zdarsky, and myself, David Brothers. Follow along with our show notes and reading list at mangasplaining.com. And today, we are here to talk about a manga from a Manga Explaining favorite, actually. Like I said, manga three times in that sentence. It's fine. But Kamame Shirahama is the creator of Witch at Atelier, which blew our minds with its stories of beautifully rendered magic and outer space toilets. And this is her, I guess, side project. It's where she goes to tell jokes, maybe?
It's her debut work.
Debut work, even better.
It wow. came before Witch at Atelier.
Yeah. She can really draw. That is absurd. But Inyale and Duiella is the story of two supernatural beings, an angel and a devil, who are roommates and best friends. They hang out all the time. And of course, because they're on opposing sides of the whole afterlife thing, it leads to funny hijinks and constant fighting. I tried this on a whim after I'd read Witch at Atelier. I was like, oh, she has other work. Let me see what this is about. And I was almost shocked at how casual it felt in comparison to Witch at Atelier. Like, Witch at's very, it feels very complete and like structured. And this is more like, I've got a gag and I've got 20 pages. What can we do with it? Yeah. But with amazing drawings. And I thought it was pretty cute. I thought the characters were very craven's not the word, egotistical, kind of, they're very modern. Like, they feel like
self-centered.
Yeah, self-centered, very selfish.
Yeah,
in ways that are really funny. You know, it's like a key to good comedy. And it's been on my mind recently because we talk about comedy off and on because Chip's, you know, a funny guy.
Oh, you.
Yeah, I try. And we talk about Shirahama as being one of our favorite artists. So I thought, oh, why not merge the two and talk about her Angel and Devil comic and its ludicrous jokes? So we'll do this old-fashioned manga-splaining style where I choose Christopher first and then Deb and then Chip and just get their reactions. Chris, what did you think of Inyale and Duiella? Can you say the title out loud once for us as a challenge?
It's not fair. I don't have it in front of me. Inyale and Duiella is you're right. It's a beautifully, like shockingly beautifully drawn book. And it reminded me actually of like North American Good Girl Cheesecake art, actually. Just like, I'm somebody who's drawing this book and I just love drawing cute girls, like being a little bit sexy and a little bit vampy sometimes in the case of Duiella, the human character. And it was just like, as soon as I hit that, that's what this book was, like, it was kind of pitched to us as a comedy, which, you know, it is. There's jokes.
Yeah.
But no, it's 170 pages of someone who really likes drawing, you know, cute girls and the occasional very buff monster dude. And that's great. There's nothing wrong with that. But I didn't find a lot more than that to it. I thought it was, you know, I thought there was some good jokes and I thought there was just like page after page of strikingly beautiful illustrations, but I can't remember what book we were talking about, but I found that although the art was really, really good, the storytelling, I had a hard time following a lot of the stories just with how the layouts of the pages were. And that wasn't a problem for Witch Hat, but I can get into that later. We can talk about more about that later, but overall, yeah, it was a fun read, but it was very fluffy and it didn't change my life.
Didn't change your life. All right. What was your take on this wonderful manga? Christopher is so unjustly maligned in his intro.
Well, this is the first work that I saw by her, right? She came to San Diego Comic-Con several years ago before Witch Hat. And she was a panelist, one of my panels about making a living in manga. And she was very, you know, quiet and stuff like that. But you know, she showed me her book. She had at the time done some beautiful Doctor Strange illustrations. And so, you know, really obvious, like she can draw. But the book, you know, that we have, what we read today was, you know, she handed me a Japanese version. I'm like, I'm not sure what's going on here, but it's awfully pretty. I still kind of feel the same way. I want to give a shout out to Caleb, the translator.
Yeah, Caleb.
He made some great decisions on the translation to make them funny. And there's also just some moments in here where it's like, Like, she just threw things in because she wanted to draw them. Like, the giant poodle. What?
Yeah.
In the middle.
Yeah.
I just want to draw a giant poodle. And then there's a part where, yeah, there's a demon motorcycle. Here we go. And then there's jet planes. Ooh, jet planes. And then there's water. It's like, she's like just flexing. Like,
yeah.
In the entire book, I just feel like she's just flexing. Like, she's saying, like, I can draw water and I can draw wind. I can draw jet planes. I can draw pretty girls in outfits. I can draw them making funny faces. I can draw zombies. Like, in a portfolio project that she just went far over and beyond what the assignment called for. I remember when I was in Japan at the time and the first volume of Witch Hat Atelier came out, every page from the first chapter was pasted up on the wall on a Tora no Ana store. You walked up the stairs, you could read the whole chapter. And I remember thinking, oh, I'm so proud of her. She's being like, this looks like a great story. And I had no flippin' idea at the time that it was going to be a great story.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? And so it's like this combination of her great art and a really good story. And it's like, whoa. can't lose on this one. But this one, what I enjoy reading about this is I see a sense of fun.
Mm.
You know, and that she just has this great sense of humor. And she's just saying, sure, I'm going to do this because can. And, oh, you know, yeah, these are actual demon names and these are actual mythology names. And there's some things where I feel like she didn't develop the characters well. Like, you know, the exorcist who's kind of supposed to be the enemy and the guy with the fly head. I think, like, bring him back. He's cool. You know? Oh,
yeah. BB. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I just feel like it's a fun read. It's, yeah, it's, I don't know what to think sometimes.
Sounds pretty breezy.
Yeah.
Like, it's good, but it doesn't stick with you necessarily. Is that fair?
Yeah, it's just kind of a nice little appetizer plate.
Oh, I like it. Yeah. Cool. And Chip, how about you?
I agree it's breezy, but also I like the fact that there's elements that carry over from story to story.
Mm.
That's kind of what would make me want to kind of keep going with it. Like, the gags are decent, and the art's really good, but like... Yeah, the fact that they keep causing these problems and the problems they cause get referenced in the next story makes it feel like it's building towards something, which I quite enjoyed. It is weird because, like, going into this, like, knowing it was the Witch Hat Atelier artist, I had super high expectations. And then and the art is really good, but you can definitely tell that Witch Hat Atelier is, like, a next step up art-wise. Like, here the drawings are great, but the pages aren't necessarily great. Like there's the digital problem of like pulling out and kind of weird little details and in individual panels where it's like, oh, it doesn't actually gel as a page because you're focused so much on each individual drawing and packing so much in, even when it's not necessary. Whereas Witch Hat Atelier, like those pages feel like perfectly composed. But yeah, obviously she draws amazingly. And yeah, whether it's fighter jets or wild monsters, like my favorite is definitely the buff. What, parakeet? What is he at the end? Yeah,
the Charon, the like...
Eagle. I love that one. He's so great.
He's so great, yeah.
Yeah, he's so great, and like, the story of him is so great, too. Like, when he loses it, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Everything about that character in the book that he made is super funny. It's probably my favorite gag as well. Yeah, she really goes to town when it comes to like the monster stuff. It makes me kind of want to just read a monster book by her. As well. Nice.
And they're so sexy. That evil demon, parakeet man, is so handsome.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, like, broad chested. It's pretty good.
Yeah. Total hunk. Total hunk.
Total hunk.
This is a small digression, but if you love the parakeet man, you should probably read the manga Rooster Fighter by Zachary Watani. You know what? It's what it sounds like. Google it. You will see exactly what it sounds like.
You like parakeet head man, then you'll love Rooster Fighter.
Yeah.
I actually couldn't read that because there's a indie comic that came out. I can't remember the name of it. That's about a rooster that gains human intelligence and then understands like what chickens go through in the life cycle.
Whoa.
I'll put it in the show notes. I'll figure it out.
That does sound fun.
It is so intense, but really good. And it has some like crazy good jokes in it as well. Totally worth tracking down, but I can't remember the name right now because I'm not Googling. But I'll put it in the show notes. But like, I've always been afraid of reading Rooster Fighter because it's going to bring back like Slaughterhouse vibes for me because it's a sentient rooster. So yeah, I haven't read that one.
I'm looking at like page 171, where like the parakeet man absolutely loses it.
And like, rips off his shirt.
Yeah, that's
great. Oh yeah, I screen grabbed that one when I was
reading. Yeah, just like, and just before he's got like that, just the panel, the Arthur fist, you know?
Yeah.
It's great.
Speaking of hot monsters, I just got to call out page 105 when Duella is being like sort of embraced by, I'm going to go with Baal, Lord of Lies. I can't remember who she says that is, but it's Bale? Bale, like sexy horseman.
Oh.
Obscured in shadow. Yeah. It's like, she likes drawing sexy dudes as much as sexy ladies, but that's not what this book is about. Like, this is a sexy lady book. But like, I came across that and I'm like, all right, yeah, let's, here we go.
But even The Exorcist is sexy in his own way too. Like, I think everyone in this book is sexy.
Yeah. And if they're not, it's pretty funny. Like the what's his name? Which archangel at the end comes and is like, is it really worth everyone, all these souls to keep these two people on earth? And like, he looks stern and like upsetting.
Yeah.
Which I think is appropriate for his character, but yeah, everyone else is either just like full on sexy or adorable. Like the way she draws the baby in the first one, or the little girl who's going to like maybe give up her soul to save her mom or whatever. It's just like, oh my God, it's gorgeous.
Pretty. I love Deb's point about Shirahama flexing as well, because page 172, 173, just after the hot parakeet guy rips off, is like a super gothic traditional drawing of an angel with a parakeet head and like many arms expelling them.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's another one of those drawings where it's like, oh, you really wanted to do this drawing and you found a story that would fit.
Yeah.
Kind of a feeling. Like, this has clearly been something in her head for a while. It's so good. The beak looks amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, the book is a combination of, like, the specific things she wants to draw and the specific gags and just tying them together. Essentially, all this book is just tying all the little things she wants to do together. It's not necessarily a big, you know, it's breezy. There's not the big thing that's happening, but.
There's kind of a Dürer quality to it, right? Like that. Dante's Inferno drawings from Dürer, like it's very fine line work, and you can see in the way she draws wings and the way she draws hell, and you know that artist is definitely an artist that, you know, when you're in art school you go, dude, this guy can draw, right?
Yeah, I think that's such an amazing addition too, because as an artist you're like, okay, I like drawing all this stuff, but I'm going to draw about heaven and hell. What's like an artistic style I can bring in to like have my work move in that direction to tell this story better? And it's like, yeah, like 18th century engravings is what we're going to incorporate into my manga art this week. That's not something that happens a lot. That shows some pretty high level chops. Like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah. Definitely.
Clearly knows how to draw.
Dedicated art student kind of thing. Student of art, I should say, rather.
Mm.
The religious stuff in this I thought was kind of interesting because it's almost like Wikipedia Catholicism.
So Japanese.
Wikipedia Catholicism.
Like, explain.
If you skim the wiki page for Catholicism and just get all like the cool lore and not any of the other stuff.
Mm.
Like in the first story, the baby is a pigeon because God saw a hot pigeon on earth. It was like, oh, I should have sex with that. Which isn't like really a Christian God thing.
That's a Zeus thing. Yeah.
So she's like really picking and choosing. And I think it leads to a cool effect where it feels like a gag manga that's sort of like elevated isn't like a word I like to use in regards to art, because I feel like all art's on the same level. But like it pushes it in a weird direction where it's almost like Baroque comedy, kind of. Does that make sense?
Yeah. That works. It's funny, the pigeon thing kind of changed my outlook on this, the whole thing a bit. Because when you have like the angel and the demon, you're kind of expecting, oh, you know, there's going to be a problem with God at some point. But then like God's kind of a moron. Like he has a pigeon, locked up a pigeon, and now there's a pigeon baby. And he had to send someone to go get it.
Yeah.
Like it changes the stakes a little bit. It makes it kind of a bit more fun. Mm. So while it's sacrilegious, I was like, I appreciated it.
The part where Innie calls God on the cell phone and Doobie's like, ugh.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I want to bring it back to, like, remember when we walked on another one where it had a lot of historical or mythology references? St. Young Men?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Same vibe. Definitely the same vibe. I would actually say St. Youngman is maybe closer to the religion it's referencing.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Man, that's so good, though.
Wikipedia Catholicism is,
pretty funny.
Also, just, I feel like I could say that about me and my Daredevil run, but that's another story.
I know, like, if you read ahead to Volume 2, she does get into the Japanese mythology, and it just doesn't, it just doesn't work as well.
Yeah.
It's just not as much fun.
Yeah, really, because she referenced it a couple times here with, like, that she referenced a couple of Buddhists, like, observances. And I was like, oh, that would be really fun to, like, show how all these religions are, or all this mythology, all of it is real.
Mm-hmm.
But also, it, like, it all sort of coexists in a way. But you're saying that in Volume 2, it doesn't really work for you?
It's like, basically, she throws them into Japan, and then they're mind blown because Japan is just full of hundreds and thousands of gods.
Mm.
And they're like, what do we do with all this?
Interesting.
Nice.
It's fun, but, you know, it's kind of more fun when they're, you know, when Eniel and Duliel are kind of like, they understand the way the world works. And then when they're confronted with a whole nother mythology, they're kind of more on the side.
I could see it.
Yeah, their bumbling makes more sense in the God and heaven and hell kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Almost like they're scheming to get around rules that they know versus like being surprised by stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, like when you go to Japan, right? Like all of us, the first time you go to Japan, it's like, wait, what? The trains are on time? And wait, how do I get from here to there? And wait. You're not going to give me my change in my hand. You're going to put in a tray. All the little shit just. Or like, oh, why are they asking me, do I want to do one or two times on the credit card? Like, oh, because they think I'm Japanese and they think they're asking me whether I want to split up my credit card payment for this one item in one or two times. Like, you know, when, you know what I mean? It's like when you're in Japan the first time, you're just like, I don't know what's going on.
Like, I'm having a great time, but I don't know.
I feel so stupid every day.
Yeah,
so I like them better in like the heaven and hell thing, because then you know what the rules are, right? Like, this one's trying to get the souls. This one's trying to, you know,
save the souls.
And but they're at the same time, they're both like, I don't know, like Kendall Jenner.
Yeah,
you know, like what's Kendall Jenner and like who's the other chick? I forget. I don't even know these girls.
Very shallow.
Whatever. Anyways, they just want to shop and like they get mad at each other for using expensive cosmetics. And I don't know. It's cute.
Christopher, have you read Kaoru Mori's Anything or Something?
No, I haven't. The short story collection? No.
Yeah.
Haven't read it yet.
Deb, how about you? Have you seen it?
Yeah, it's kind of similar to this.
Yeah, I was thinking that because there are all these interludes in her short story collection. And Kaoru Mori is the artist of A Bride Story, which we all, you know, were blown away by. Ages ago.
And this was originally in Hartet too, by the way.
The same magazine?
Yeah.
Oh, awesome.
Eniel and Duliola was originally in like Hartet Arc Fellows, like those magazines. Whereas Witch Hat Atelier is in a Kodansha like Seinen magazine.
Mm, pretty good pedigree.
Yeah, so like Hartet's kind of like, nice drawing, pretty girls. Yeah.
And a lot of Anything and Something is about Mori's love of drawing pretty girls in elaborate outfits.
Yeah.
Like there's a moderately famous comic strip online where like an editor is explaining like, oh, you like you draw, you know, maid outfits and glasses and blah, 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 blah. And the artist character is getting closer and closer saying, yes, that's important. That's the most important part. That's the most important part. And this definitely has a similar vibe where it's like, she's playing around in a very serious way. Like this is her thing. And she's going to try to express her thing in as many different ways as she can. From monsters to art history to even just like cute outfits.
Yeah, there's like that whole fashion show page where they're in Paris. Yeah. And it's like, here's a page of them in just different outfits. It had like real, bring me back to reading Archie comics where you would get like a Betty and Veronica fashion section.
Uh-huh. 100%. As a kid. Yeah.
And it was like so great. I really loved it.
Even this one of them all in like different panels and posing.
Yeah.
That one. That was so great.
That was amazing. Page 66-ish, maybe.
Mm.
It actually made me think of, like, Paradise Kiss.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, it feels like she grew up, I mean, I'm sure, you know, the timing works out, but it feels like she grew up reading comics like that. You know, it's something about the faces, like the pointiness of the chins. I don't know.
Mm. Actually, it's funny. You mentioned that they just, your erstwhile employer just announced that they're going to do the Paradise Kiss prequel. Nice. That neighborhood story manga that sort of turned into Paradise Kiss, which I've been waiting to read forever. And you're right. It does have a similar... The bouncy qualities of that are definitely the bouncy qualities in this, although Paradise Kiss went away after the bouncy qualities. But yeah, I can't wait to read. Can't wait to read that too.
Nice.
Yeah.
The Harta Bride story thing is kind of more self-indulgent. This sounds bad, self-indulgent, but it's not in a bad way. It's just kind of like, you know, like how Crum draws women a certain way because he wants to, that's the women he wants to see in the world, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I love self-indulgent stuff in comics.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
it's a hard work. You might as well, you know, do stuff you like while you're doing it.
yeah.
I gotta ask a question though. For all of you guys, are you team Annie or team Dewey?
Okay, I'm team. I don't think I'm necessarily a team, but there was one panel in here that I found so erotic that I had to catch my breath a little bit, and it like unlocked like maybe a new thing for me. It's page 72. So I'll let you go to page 72.
We're all desperately scrolling to find what's turning Chip on.
It's when the exorcist reaches behind and discovers the tail.
Searching.
It's a wild drawing.
It is a wild drawing, and like everything about it is just like way too erotic for what this book is. Like the fact that like the coat is lifted up on that side reveals everything almost to her butt, and then the way he's touching the tail too is not like a full grip. It's just like just enough, and there's like a phallic quality to the tail and at the base, and it's wrong, and it blew my mind.
I love the searching lettering behind it too. Like the layout is so like they kind of form
and then the
an
tail
A.
Is S2, yeah,
yeah,
right?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. It's a very strange panel in terms of the design of it, but yeah, it's something else.
And then the joke that follows it is basically like a Rano 1/2 joke of like a stomp and a slap and a runaway.
yeah.
Chip, is there anything you would compare this to in like American comics, Western comics?
I mean,
I was going to say Rocketeer, man.
Rocketeer.
Well, yeah.
Rock-a-who?
I could see that.
But Dave Stevens, who did Rocketeer, is just like a pinup guy, loves cheesecake, loves good girl art, and was like, what do I want to draw? And it was like 1950s retro futurism, dude with like a metal mask and a ray gun, and just the cutest possible girls. And so Rocketeer was like born of his self-indulgent comics.
Yeah.
And there's nothing, and again, nothing wrong with that. It was, for me, I look at that and you read it and you're like, God, it's just like beautifully drawn, and he loves drawing girls, and like he's putting some like fun 1950s set pieces in there. Sure, Rocketeer. It's a fun time, but that's the vibe I got off of this person.
Is Rocketeer meets Good Omens?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely. Good high concept.
Yeah,
nice.
Get Hollywood on the phone.
When you guys said cheesecake, I thought Frank Cho.
I could see it, but this is almost like more horny, but less openly horny.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, that's it. Yeah, Frank Cho. He's basically just like, hey, you want to be horny here?
Yeah.
Whereas this is like, oh, read this fun thing. Oh, by the way, you know what? It's horny.
And after thinking about it, I think I'm team Dewey instead of team Annie. Mm. She gets more of the like mean-spirited jokes that make me laugh.
Yeah.
And the bit where the exorcist is like, oh, we have wanted her for ages. And you see like the really like classic monstrous version.
You have her? Yeah, that was really good.
Yeah, page 88. Yeah. There's just so many good bits with her that I like a lot. Yeah,
for sure.
Oh, yeah. Then the chapter 3 title art is a great outfit. Mm. And again, very horny. Like, there's so many good details in the drawings where you're like, oh, okay, I get it.
Yeah.
Like the perfect line down the pantyhose.
Yeah.
Annie gets the good expressions. I think Dewey gets the really good jokes, but Annie, like, there's something about the way she draws a sort of like concerned shock face on Annie, which happens multiple times in this volume, that is so good, like so complex an emotion to try and communicate in drawing, and it's so perfectly done sort of each time.
Yeah.
But only one of them gets embraced by Monster Men, so I might have to go with Team Dewey. I'm Team Monster Man, actually. There we go.
Yeah. How about you, Deb? Who was your Betty or Veronica?
You know, I could relate to more Dewey because it's like if you had a girlfriend like in Yale who basically borrows your shit shamelessly, doesn't apologize for it, and then just bats her eyelashes and goes like, "But I'm cute, right? Oh, you just want to slap her." So it's like
you sent her back to heaven.
Yeah, so I could relate to her problems and stuff like that. But you know, at the same time, there's something really fun about the innocence and the stupid problems they get into.
Yeah,
I don't know. It's like I have to draw like so. I have to mention page 108. Mm. That was the one where I thought Caleb Cook, you go. It's basically this hoof coming out and it says, "Silence." The master.
I wonder if in Japanese it was like ashi is Japanese for leg and shin is Japanese, like sounded like for silence.
Ashin.
Yeah. Caleb's really good at what he does. Caleb Cook and Abigail Blackman on lettering. I think they did a great job localizing this one.
Oh, I wonder if it says something in the translation notes about that.
There were only a few notes.
They don't
a handful.
See it. Damn it.
On page 97, though, in that same area, there was something that I wanted us to take a look at. Like the storytelling. Basically, there's a fight scene in this volume. So, of course, you know, my eyes and heart zoomed towards it on page 96, 97, where our angel and demon friend are summoned. They look at each other and then they have like a quick hand-to-hand Batman Captain America thing over nine panels. I think this was maybe the funniest part for me because it's so serious and like suddenly action comic-y. While the rest of the book is like pretty open and like, you know, beautiful drawings.
Well, the best part of it is on 97, the Batman Captain America.
Yeah.
Is that both of their faces throughout are bored.
Like, or that's, annoyed. That's, they look annoyed with each other. Like oh, yeah, you again.
Yeah, it's bored annoyance. Like it's...
Yeah.
That's what makes the page super, super funny.
And the texture on her jacket's, I mean, it must be digital, but it's a great texture. I don't know. There's so many good drawings in this book.
I don't know if it's digital. It really shifts a lot from panel to panel. Like if it's digital, she's doing a lot of work on it to sort of, you know, squash and stretch it and move it a little bit. Like,
Usually with something like that, it's easier to just draw than try and manipulate it.
She's really fast, too.
Really?
When she was at the panel, at the end, somebody had a shikishi. She drew Dewey like that. Like, and I have a picture of it, and she just whipped it out with a Sharpie. So it is my eternal regret that I was too...
Professional?
I didn't want to ask her for one. I felt really bad, you know, like, oh, you know, I don't want to bother you, but, you know, here's a fan, and she's asking you to draw something. But I look at I look at that phone, like, oh, it's so jealous.
But Deb, you read through volume 3? So can you tell us a little bit about where it goes? Like, does it develop a story arc or does it just kind of stay more Monster of the Weekish?
It's kind of episodic.
Yeah.
I can see why it ended in 3 volumes because it was just like not really going anywhere.
Yeah.
But, you know, it like, again, you know, the flexing thing, definitely, if you read it with that in mind, you go like, okay, here's the zombies, here's the this, here's the that. Like, it's if you could use it as a textbook for drawing comics, it's like, you could look at it as a reference, like, oh, that's how you draw people underwater. Oh, that's how you draw explosions like that. When you have a demon that does this. And you want to do it at this angle where the motorcycle is flying up. That's how you do it. It's beautiful drawn, but I don't know if it holds together as a story.
Yeah.
man, I don't think most people would have gotten that far or taken it that far just to have fun.
Yeah, good drawings go a long way, I think.
Mm. When we read Witch Hat Atelier, compared to this especially, when I think about those pages, they had so much more white space on them. Mm. I'd have to go back and compare directly. But that's maybe the big change for this, is that like every page and every panel is just jammed full of stuff. Like some of these pages I've been counting as we've been sort of scrolling through real quick, have like eight or nine panels on them, which is crazy to me for a manga. Mm-hmm.
That's just pure ambition, right? That's just like, yeah, she's got so much I want to say.
Yeah, like so much I want to do. And I feel like on the whole, Witch Hat Atelier was a lot more relaxed.
Yeah.
Came to telling its story.
Well, it's like I was saying early on, it's more designed. The pages are designed. Here, everything's crammed, so there's no focus on most of the pages. I just randomly had a page 100 open, and there's so many details in this kitchen, like every panel. But like as a page, it's just like, okay, like where's my eye going? Is there like a focal point here? Like
not just so many details in the kitchen and details in the page, but 10 panels on that page.
Yeah,
on a manga. You know what I mean? Like. I'm reading it on an iPad, or actually a computer screen right now. So it's blown up pretty big. So nothing feels muddy to me exactly, but it also doesn't lead the eye very well. The only white space is in the word balloons. And that's like a weird, it's always a weird choice.
Yeah. And it's kind of the thing that an artist does with an early work because their concern is not putting enough in. Like they want to be seen as like, I can do this job. Look, I can draw everything on this. Like I had that. Even if you look at like my first issue of Sex Criminals, like I drew every goddamn like book on every shelf, every brick.
Unique titles for each book.
Unique titles for every book. I mean, I didn't fully lose that, but I just remembered at some point to stay zoomed out, to not get in and draw every bit of hair on a character, because you're not actually helping the page at all with that.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think most kind of artists, when they're starting out, especially on a thing that feels like a debut, usually kind of go too far with the details and not enough with the composition and the page design.
I think an extreme example of that is Tsutomu Nihei. We did, you know, our Nihei episode where we looked at a lot of his work and how it went from almost like 80% black pages to like 15% black over the course of like 10 years.
Yeah.
And he was really figuring out what to draw and what not to draw. Steve Lieber, the artist of Superman's pal Jimmy Olsen with friend of the podcast Matt Fraction, he talks about how he only allows himself to zoom in a certain amount when he's drawing digitally, because otherwise it's pointless.
Yeah, I'm exactly the same. I stop at like, it's like 100%, 150%, I think, on my screen. And like, going in any farther than that is not going to help.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Awesome. So there's this thing I like that I've been revisiting in comics lately, kind of the idea of a solo anthology, like DC Solo, which would have one artist doing several stories. There's Dustin Weaver's Packlist that I like a lot. I think there's like 6 or 7 issues of that out. And they always feel kind of similar to this to me, almost like training grounds or like workshops, I would say, places to try different storytelling techniques and ideas that you might find better success with later. And I think that ties into the point about learning what to leave out and, you know, panel count and everything else, because this is dense. I've forgotten how dense it was when I recommended it. Did it feel like, was it slow to read? How did you guys make your way through it? Was it pretty easy?
I was pretty challenged by it, honestly, but I think, and I don't want to go too hard on it, 'cause I don't think it was that bad, but it was like, oh, the storytelling is rough. Yeah. The way that she's moving people through this story, it does hurt a little bit when you're trying to read it. But, you know, I didn't find it an easy read by any stretch of the imagination. I would get 4 or 5 panels along and be like, wait, what happened? Because it didn't absorb exactly the same way as it did if it had been designed, like Chip's saying, like if it had been designed a little bit better.
Yeah, yeah.
Not an easy read exactly. And I wasn't lost, maybe like Deb said in her intro, but I did... I wasn't able to plow through this at all. Like it took me about 1.5 hours to read, just having to go back a little bit and you know what I mean? And that, and I would be like turning the iPad around and being like, look, she drew this time to Andrew. And she's like, that's amazing. Like, that's so incredible. Yeah. There's so many drawings like that that you just want to like show people that are sitting next to you while you're reading. So, yeah.
A beginner problem that a lot of artists go through, especially if they're good artists or good illustrators, mm-hmm. is they, you know, they get used to drawing the pinup pages.
Yeah.
The preening pages, shots. Right? And then they have a hard time, like, the common complaint I hear from most comic editors is like, I don't want to just see pinups. I want to see visual storytelling.
Mm-hmm.
And so on this hand, it's like her pinups are outstanding. Her double mm-hmm. page spreads are jaw dropping. But it's like the storytelling in between is like, how can I make it till the next pinup, right? Yeah. Moment.
Towards the end, you get to a point where there's like a hero shot every two or three pages, you know?
Yeah.
The thing that she needs to draw. But something that struck me while I was reading this, and this slipped out of my head earlier, was the localization. We've talked about Caleb and Abigail's work a little bit. But Chip, I was curious, did this read like a normal, or did this read like a familiar manga to you, or like they were doing something different? Like, where did you land with the localization of this one?
Yeah, I'm not even sure how to answer that. Like, I just like read it and it made sense to me, I guess, is
okay.
there wasn't anything in there that jumped out and was like, what does that mean? Like,
yeah,
it was pretty straightforward. Is there anything in there that you saw that like makes you think otherwise?
I could immediately tell it was like a looser, not loose, that's the wrong word. Like it was localized rather than like directly translated.
Mm. Okay.
The stuff like the Thylance joke, some of the stuff with the baby and the phrasing, like it felt more smooth than manga feels frequently, I would say. Like there's like manga writing that you would expect from Shonen Jump where it's like very direct and I'm going to be king of the pirates, blah, 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 blah. And then there's this where it's actually kind of like closer to how people talk.
But it has to be, right? For comedy. Like if it sounds stiff, then it loses that humor, right? And I think you have to localize it to the point where you're giving an English reader the same experience, the same moments where they smile, the same moments where they think it's funny as a Japanese reader. Now, it doesn't matter if it's not a one-to-one translation. You're giving the English reader that same feelings that Shirahama was trying to convey.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's funny because like we talked about this on the episode with Jocelyn and translating Okinawa because that was very straightforward.
Yeah.
Like you didn't have that localization because it was nonfiction, it was dramatic, and it was basically like kind of a one-for-one translation that she would just have to smooth over instead of kind of like reaching and figuring out like puns. Like something like this.
Yeah, not a lot of puns in that one.
Yeah, I mean like there was one thing, I think it was like a newscast in here where somebody said, "What on earth is happening to Earth?" And I'm just like, like, oh, is there a phrase similar in Japanese that
they
base that off of, or was it all the localization?
Yeah, I don't think there's a right answer to that kind of like the right way to do localization thing, but I like being able to see the differences in approach in a book like this or a book like Okinawa, because it's, I know, it's almost like getting a peek behind the curtain a little bit, like trying to intuit their motives or what they were going for. But Christopher, what are your kind of feelings on this kind of localization versus something more straightforward?
I think when I was younger and writing about comics, I never really understood what went into the process of localizing humor, especially. Mm-hmm. And as I started making friends with more editors and more translators and things like that, and this is still 15 years ago, it sort of became apparent. Because there'd be every once in a while, and I always go back to Heartbroken Angels, which was a Viz gag strip comics where Same Hat comes from.
Oh,
Ryan Sands' Same Hat. That's like one of those strips. You'd have this idea that of like a joke, especially if it's wordplay or a pun that's in Japanese that doesn't have a direct translation. And sometimes you can't massage it into something that means exactly the same thing. So you just look at the artwork and tell a joke that's in the same register, rather than telling the same joke. Like, all right, this is a fart joke. I guess we're telling a different kind of fart joke that matches what's in the word balloons, because literally it does not come across. Like we cannot make the Japanese work here. And I think a lot of translators do that. I know, like, Chip, you've had a lot of work translated into other languages now. And it's like, yeah, sometimes jokes don't, in English jokes just don't land. Like, they like, it's not a popular style of humor. They don't really use that style of humor in a different language. So yeah. The translator is just like, I got to put something here that's funny that'll elicit the same kind of laugh. I think like Deb was saying. But I do know that there is this kind of awful opinion online that anything that's not a direct translation that does localize or does push something in a way to make it palatable, let's say, for Western readers, is a betrayal of the mangaka. And it's like,
sorry, bullshit. I just want to. You're saying there was a terrible opinion online?
Just the one. Just about manga translation.
All right, good. Did we got to the bottom of it?
Yeah. So yeah, I think that's fake as hell. And it's not to say that there's not bad translations out there or there's not great translations out there that are super faithful. But at the same time, like, this is art, man. This isn't like there's different ways to approach these works in translation, and nothing is actually perfect. And we're always sort of striving to get as close as we can. And I think that that's what's so important.
It's funny. Yeah. With my work, when it's being translated, once in a blue moon, I'll get like an email from someone who's doing the translating to ask if they can change a joke, like to make it make more sense for the language.
Yeah.
And I'm like, of course, yeah, no problem. Because I remember, and I've brought it up before here, talking to Jim Davis about Garfield being translated into other countries, like Japan especially, I think was tricky for him, and they needed to rewrite those jokes a lot and just put in new jokes, like what Chris was saying. But because they contact me to ask, you know, if they can change it once in a while, I just keep thinking about the ones that don't contact me.
Oh yeah. Dozens.
Is my work like just misogynistic in another country? Like, I just don't know. I don't know. Like, yeah, if I ever go to like Italy or whatever, they'll hail me as like a hero for the wrong reasons or something. And yeah. Yeah. A slight fear there.
Amazing. Yeah, my go-to when thinking about localization in general, and especially localizing comedy, is how curry, like the dish, and boyfriend in Japanese are homophones. Homophones?
Oh.
Homophones. They're both fine.
Ever since Christopher did Root versus Route, I have second-guessed myself so frequently.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. But no, they, like, if you say curry, kare, it's the dish or it's a boyfriend. And there's a lot of jokes like, oh, I really want some curry right now. And it's like, oh, I want a boyfriend right now. Mm. And it doesn't scan in English. Like, you got to either commit to the unfunny direct translation or find something else. And yeah, lots of varying opinions on that, let's say.
I just read that. Actually, I can't remember what book it was, but they just decided to be like, in the gloss at the bottom, note, curry and the Japanese word for boyfriend sound similar. And they just left the joke in and were like, I'm trying to fix this. Dude, you get a note. You get a note on that.
It's wild. Yeah. It's like it's almost not enough of a joke to put the effort for to find a different thing. You know, like what are you going to replace that with? There's like nothing even close. So you have to come up with a brand new joke.
Translation scientists working around the clock to figure it out.
I went to a Village Vanguard with Aki Yanagi, a friend of the podcast, and there's instant curry that has pictures of hot guys on, like hot manga looking guys on it. And I thought, oh, it's hot guy curry. It's hot curry. And he goes like, no, it's kare curry. And he had to explain the pun to me.
Yeah.
Nice.
There are these post-it notes with hot guys, hot manga guys on it. They're ikemenmos.
Oh, that's pretty good. Oh.
So ikemen is means hot guy. So ikememo is a pun. Like a lot of Japanese humor is puns, and it's a big headache.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's like a good looking notebook, and maybe is how
got your editor brain out today, huh?
David.
Yeah, no kidding. Good job.
Jeez, I keep hitting my mic while we record. By the way, but we should probably do final thoughts. Let's do Christopher, Deb, and then Chip. Christopher, what's your final thought on Annie and Dewey?
Just looking at page, I think it's 160 here, where after all of the like trying to get the spa, the bath, the onsen together, Annie finally slips into the bath, and it's so sensually drawn, and like every part of this lady's body is drawn in a way that it has like weight and form and three-dimensional. It's just like, man, this is like a well-drawn and obviously sexy, doesn't personally, but like very sexy situation, very well-drawn. And it's just like, yeah, that's what, and it's so ornate too. Like there's like the drawings around the framing and whatever.
Is it like Alphonse Mucha style? Is that
yeah? It's got like a real Art Nouveau thing all the way through Alphonse Mucha for sure. So like yeah, I think that this is a gorgeously drawn cheesecake book that has some really great jokes sort of underpinning the whole thing, so that it doesn't once feel gross, doesn't once feel like I don't know about this. It's like no, we're just gonna keep doing like funny gags and beautiful drawings and fashion. And I'm super happy that a book like this exists. And if she was ever going to go back and do more, I'd actually maybe be even more interested in that, because yeah. I think the only thing from my perspective holding it back is the storytelling and how cramped she chooses to make a lot of these pages, when there would be nothing wrong with just like, I don't know, do half as many stories and twice as many pages per story, get all your gags in, but let some of these illustrations that are gorgeous be full page illustrations. Really, like you drew it like it was a full page illustration. There's so much detail in this like little quarter page thing. Like, blow it up, have a good time, like rework it. And yeah, and I want to go back and read more Witch Hunt Atelier now, just to see, because this is so fresh, like I just read this, to see like where the storytelling goes, because I remember it being so much stronger just three volumes, like these three volumes and then Atelier, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
that's huge. And that might be the difference in editors in Harta and the Kodansha magazine she's in. It might be her growth or research that she's done or thrown out a bunch of drafts. I don't know. If we ever get a chance to talk to her, I'd love to ask her about how the style changed so much between those books, because yeah, she really leveled up for Witch Hunt Atelier. And I say that, and this is awesome. Like, this isn't like, oh, she finally came into her own. No, this is great. Like, beautiful, beautiful book. But I do think that she hit next level with Witch Hunt Atelier, and especially as the series has gone on.
I'm flipping through Witch Hunt Atelier right now, and like, it's so rare to break out of like just five panels a page.
Yeah.
Like, once in a while you'll get, and when you do get pages that have like 8-9 panels, it's for a storytelling reason. Like, it's a montage, or it's like, yeah, it's a sequence that needs to be that way, instead of just cramming it in to cram it in. So that's clearly a big thing there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Deb, how about you? Final thoughts?
I was kind of curious, why did you pick this one, David?
It was the drawings, I think. Like, why did I pick it to read or to bring to the podcast?
Oh, no. Yeah. What was your reason for picking it for us to read?
Getting another look at Shirahama, actually. Like, I like when we can get kind of a fuller picture of the artist that we talk about a lot, because usually it's like a hit and then run, and it's like a first volume hit and run.
Yeah.
And so seeing a work like Witch Hunt Atelier that's like really complete and, you know, devastatingly impressive, let's say, and then going back to see what she did before that, I think is always kind of interesting. Sort of like, oh, you know, what was Neil Gaiman up to before Sandman? And it's like, oh, like short stories in the British Comics Press.
So you didn't pick this because of the panel where he grabs her tail gently?
It was actually the one on the page before that where he reveals the tail.
Oh. Gotcha. All right. Oh. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Satisfying. Yeah. No, I was just kind of curious, because it's like there's always some, you know, like your choices are always really interesting, right? Because sometimes they're like, hi, I'm just going to screw with you. And sometimes it's like, this really scratched an itch for me. And I was so tickled by this particular thing, or I want to use this as an excuse to talk about something. But I mean, and now that you mention it, it's like, I know that, like, what I find really interesting about your approach to manga is that you like seeing artists develop, or you like seeing, you like seeing a career. I guess it's like seeing who the creator is, and the ways that they change and grow and better, or go in what direction or another. It's an interesting kind of scholarly approach, but not, that's the wrong word for it. Like you're you're fascinated by creators. That's what I think is interesting.
Yeah, I think scholarly is fair because it comes out of like my approach to criticism, which is, you know, like how does this make me feel and how can I say it in a way that gets it across to someone else? But it's funny you said that because I just got the Otomo book that's like got his comics from when he was 17 years old in the mail. So that is like totally my bag, I think. Like, I think you and Christopher are very good at like the overall market sort of thing. And I'm bad at business, but I feel pretty okay at art. So something like this for me is always sort of like, where does it fit in context with, you know, their other work?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Yeah.
I enjoy it too. I mean, it's kind of like watching a band develop, you know, like, you know, how their musical influences. And then like in this particular case, like it's really interesting to see her, she's just a virtuoso artist, and to see like, okay. She experimented with a lot of things. And then when she went to the next one, she learned how to harness those powers in a more focused way.
Yeah.
Characterization, visual storytelling. Like there's so many great characters she introduces. I wish she took this a little further, you know? Like the side characters are like, this is an interesting concept for a story. I wish you took that and let it run a little bit longer. Mm-hmm. But, you know, these are all very, very minor criticisms. And it's interesting to see because it's like, if you just only saw Witch at Atelier, you would not know this person, even in an earlier work. It's just knocking it out of the park without even breaking a sweat in a way that most people would dream of doing. But the fact that she went on to create something next, that was like, just you're perfect, right?
Mm-hmm. Was Witch Hat right after this? Or was there anything in between, really?
I believe so, yeah.
I think she took some time, though. We'll throw that in the show notes. But I believe that it wasn't this serialization ended and then next month, Witch Hat Atelier. There was definitely...
Yeah, it was a while.
Yeah, she must have, because there's an actual development in the style, too, which I don't think you'd hit just by like, all right, I'm going to start drawing.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah.
And we've done that with Tatsuki Fujimoto a bit, too, looking at different works of his and kind of comparing and contrasting. Chip, what's your final thought? How do you feel about this one?
Horny, I told you.
Oh, right.
Gotta end this episode right now.
No, it's fun. A lot of the jokes land. The monster, buff monsters are probably my favorite part.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Chris called it when he said it was breezy. Like, this is a very breezy book. And if you're looking for that, and you're looking for good drawings, and you should definitely check it out.
Nice. And my final thought is, I agree with you all about the jokes being just kind of okay sometimes. Like, the storytelling being kind of okay, but all the drawings being, like, completely top of the heap.
Mm.
And my favorite gag, I think, is on page 82 with the demon trio. We do a quick little, like, Ginyu Force Kamen Rider pose, leap into action moment, and then immediately get, like,
flashed
dissolved.
Yeah, yeah.
That was pretty good.
But the thing that kills me is the trio guy in the middle who is covering his butt and junk by spreading his legs as wide as he can and putting one hand in front and a hand behind. It's one case where zooming in too far led to some pretty good humor, I think.
Yeah.
Nice.
But cool. That has been Inayale and Duiella by Kamome Shirahama. First time I said the title correctly. I'm pretty proud of that. It's available from Yen Press, and I hope you enjoyed our discussion about it, because it is over. We're going to take a commercial break and then do some shout-outs.
Because it's over. We're done.
Why might you want to learn a new language? For some of us on Manga Explaining, we use our knowledge of Japanese on the podcast to compare the English editions of manga to the Japanese. And honestly, reading more manga natively in Japanese, or bande dessinée in French, or webtoons in Korean, it's definitely a dream, and a great way to get there might be Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is a trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, and it truly immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone has been a trusted expert in language learning for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered. Rosetta Stone offers fast language acquisition, immersing you in a language with no English translations, an intuitive process, and it's designed for long-term retention. It uses True Accent technology to give you feedback on your pronunciation, and it's convenient with desktop and smartphone app options for offline learning. It's also an amazing value, so don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, Mongosplaining learners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today today.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Get everything you need for your next project today at Menards and save big money. LP SmartSide products are the number one brand of engineered wood siding. SmartSide trim and siding offers long-lasting performance and delivers the warmth and beauty of traditional wood. Save big money today at Menards and LP SmartSide products. Plus, visit Menards.com to view the weekly flyer and check out all of our great deals happening this week.
Save big money at
And we are back. We had a pretty decently long chat about Inielia and Duiella this week. We're going to do some shout outs and then, I don't know, we're all pretty tired. Probably take a nap, go to sleep, depending on the time zone we're in. Deb, do you have a shout out for us?
Oh, I will give a shout out to KCON in Los Angeles. Nice. I had a grand old time in the land of boy bands and girl bands. It was mind-blowing.
Were you there working or just hanging out?
Oh, well, they invited me to do a panel on webtoons and K-dramas.
Nice.
Then the people from Ice Press, with them I did a panel on K-pop and webtoons, you know, because there's the BTS and hyphen graphic novels coming out in the fall.
Mm-hmm.
So I got concert tickets, and so I got to see two nights of it. And K-pop fans, there's a once in 80 years tropical storm barreling down on LA. There's an earthquake that same day. And all they do is hand out plastic ponchos and people just went to the show. Nothing stops K-pop fans. They're going to be here at the end of the world like the cockroaches because they are so resilient and determined.
Yeah. Vibing super hard.
I had a great time. So thank you, KCON. That was eye-opening and mind-blowing.
Awesome. Chip, how about you? Did you go to KCON?
You know what? I missed it this year, and I'm kicking myself. Yeah. Just too scared of storms. My wife and I have been, we're in the middle of it right now. We're watching Star Trek Strange New Worlds.
Okay.
And Star Trek's one of those things where, like, sometimes I like it, sometimes I don't. Like, I got into Star Trek Discovery, but as it went, I'm just like, oh, I don't need you to save all of the universe again. Like, it just felt really repetitive. And Strange New Worlds is like, it's nostalgia done right, because it's not nostalgia in the sense that it's like winking at you with its references, but it's nostalgic for the feeling of kind of a classic Trek. Okay. Where there's a lot of done in ones, the characters are all interesting and likable, and it has a really kind of bright, fun feel to it, even when the topics get dark. And everyone on it is so adorable. Like, just, they're either super cute, and there's like the one hunk, Captain Pike, Anson Mount, and he is so dreamy, and his hair is so perfect. And the Star Trek outfits are, they got the perfect shoulder pads, like not too big, but just enough to make it go, all right, to like literally everyone who wears those outfits.
Nice.
It's one of those shows where, like, I text a lot with a friend of the show, Ryan North, because he's like a Star Trek fan, and he also loves it. And almost at the end of every episode, I say to my wife, I'm like, Ryan should write one of these. Like, my goal now in life is to get Ryan to write an episode of this TV show. So when the writer's strike is over, I'm just going to start a new picket line outside the Star Trek offices saying, hire Ryan North to write a Strange New Worlds episode.
His Fantastic Four is good enough to where I'm not even a Star Trek guy, and I'm on your side.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's so smart, and his work is always super fun, and he's so good at those done in ones that, like, he's a shoe-in for the show, I think.
Mm-hmm. Nice. And Christopher, you got a shout out for us this week?
Yeah, I actually haven't been taking in a lot of media lately. I've been mostly consuming stuff for work. So I will do Enlightened Self-Interest shout out. Shout out the collaborators on all the Mongsplaining Extra books, because we're starting to get pages and chapters in. So we've got the first four chapters of Search and Destroy in. Awesome. It's Search and Destroy is by Atsushi Kaneko. Ben Applegate translated it, and Phil Christie's doing the lettering. And the lettering is coming in, and the pages on Search and Destroy are awesome already, because he does, like, all of his sound effects are like Kaneko Sensei's sound effects are like these, like, chonky, like, inward balloon things. And Phil's doing an amazing job at, like, exactly translating that feel. It's so good. And then we got in the first book of Veil, actually. Kevin sent in over the letters, and Jocelyn translated it. And it's so nice. It's just like I'm luxuriating in that on the iPad screen, because it's color and it's beautiful and, like, fashionable. And then I read the first chapter of Wandering Cat's Cage, the Deb's editing. We're going through the rework on that, and Sarah Lindsay lettered it, and Jocelyn translated that one as well. And it's like, oh, these are good books. Like, it's just, it's weird, because you pick them and then you work for like a year and a half to 2 years to actually get them into English with contracts and things like that. And then when the work finally begins, it's like, oh, right. That was what I wanted the whole time, was actually get to see manga get made, and it's really good and people are really going to love it. That's awesome. It's a good feeling after, like, dealing with contracts and dealing with delays and dealing with whatever. So yeah, shout out to all the folks that are working on, and Deb obviously, but all the folks working on the Mongsplaining Extra books right now. It's been real nice getting to see pages and chapters and whole books come in at a time. And I always have something to read right now, which is super nice. Super, super nice. So yeah, that's been great.
I'm excited to find out what they're actually saying in Veil.
I read that one. It was interesting. I was listening to the Okinawa episode. That one I actually read the French, because it's all short dialogue. So it was pretty easy for me to pick up. Whereas Higa's work in French is a little denser. Okinawa was a little denser.
Yeah.
But it was. It's like, I mean this in the best possible way that is not a criticism. It's actually like a proponent of why it's good. But it's a bit like a French perfume commercial from the late 90s and early 2000s, where, like, people are looking glamorous and kind of talking past each other. And there's this, like, it's like French, you know, not new wave cinema, but like classic French cinema. And they're just like smoldering and, like, talking about, you know, sexy things. And you're like, wait, what is that? And it just, but you're already on to the next thing. Veil's so good. Veil's so good. And it's going to be, and it's beautiful.
A killer pitch.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. It's going to be, I honestly don't think there's anything like it in English. And like in manga, in English language comics, it's a romance book that is told in these snippets of beautiful people having this cat and mouse, although that's problematic, sort of situation where they're both in charge at all times. Like, they're both like, oh, well, maybe this. And she's like, well, wouldn't you like to know? And it's like so great. It's like so will they, won't they? So cute. Totally love it. So, yeah. Veil's great, but all the books are great. Anyway, yada, yada, yada.
I discovered her work initially because she did all this amazing fan art for Mad Max Fury Road.
Wow. That's very
so that's
far away from this.
Her work. And I bought her doujinshis and I'll scan it in. They're amazing. But then when she started doing this work, and I remember showing this to you at a Tayo, okay, look, Chris, isn't this beautiful? Yeah. I don't know what this is about, but this is beautiful.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Well, congrats. That sounds really cool, honestly. Like the discovery, but also like getting things done side of things.
Yeah, getting things done is nice. It's nice to be productive.
Yeah. So my shout out is the opposite of getting things done, because Armored Core 6 Fires of Rubicon came out on PlayStation 5.
Oh.
Which is a giant robot combat game set in, you know, a far-flung future where there's humans on a bunch of planets. We do giant robot combat to settle, you know, business negotiations, kind of.
Yeah.
I fought a lot of corporations and governments and, like, students for some reason. I think I might be the bad guy. But the first mission, you wake up and your boss is like, we got to get you a call sign so you can be a legal mercenary. Go find a dead robot out there and take its, like, identification stuff. And then it's just all bad vibes from there on down. But it's such a good game. Fun gameplay, great setting, highly recommended.
All right.
Man. And it's the reason why I'm getting nothing done for the next, I don't know, 100 hours, maybe? We'll see.
The one question I don't know about that, because I've been following a little bit online. Did they release a special controller for that one, too? Because some of the old Armor Cores,
no,
they had
the old game, that was consoles. I forget the name of that one. That was an Xbox game. It wasn't Armored Core, though.
It was a Capcom game?
Yeah, Steel Battalion is what that was called.
Oh, okay.
And it had, like, an actual mech, like, dashboard that you would have to use.
Yeah,
that's crazy. No, this is just a controller.
Oh, okay, good.
Moved away from that kind of excess. You would find that in the Mandarake, where Chip had his big epiphany about there's being too much stuff in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go.
But that's an episode of Long Explaining, I think. We covered Iniella and Duiella. We did some shout-outs. We did some enlightened self-interest. And now we are going to go take a break. Thank you for listening. This has been Manga Explaining, episode number 106, Iniella and Duiella. Thanks for listening. For our next episode, we'll be discussing the manga Cherry Magic by Yu Toyoda. Want to pick up a copy? Consider supporting your local comic book and manga specialty shop. Find one near you at comicshoplocator.com or check out your local library for print and digital lending options. You can also follow along with a complete reading list at mangaexplaining.com and check out our newsletter and digital publishing endeavor at mangaexplainingextra.com. Thanks to DADS for the musical accompaniment this episode.
Get everything for your next project today at Menards and save big money. Keep your walls and trim protected while you paint with Scotch Blue Painter's Tape. It's designed for use on multiple surfaces and can be removed easily without leaving residue behind. Save big on Scotch Blue Painter's Tape from Menards. Also, view our weekly flyer on Menards.com and check out all of our great deals happening this week. Save big money at
Menards. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.